Hi there, and thanks for joining us. This episode is coming from Páirc Cuíve, recorded on the morning of the most recent Cork Chamber Business Breakfast, because the special guest there was the CEO of Ireland's largest bank, and he's here to talk to us. I'm Jonathan Healy, and this is Red Business.
Red Business, Cork's exclusive business podcast.
Colin Hunt, CEO of AIB, you're very welcome to Red Business. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jonathan. Good to be here.
You are a man who has a bit of Cork history. I know you're Waterford born, but you spent a considerable amount of time here in your younger days, did you?
Yeah, I went to university here in UCC between 87 and 92. Did a Bachelor of Commerce degree, specialised in economics, and then did a Master's in Economic Science.
Happy days?
Very, very happy days. Very, very fond memories of the college and the city. Enduring friendships lasting for decades afterwards. And I met my wife in college. So I not only got an academic education, but I also managed to get a marital future out of the place as well. So it's a place that's very close to my heart.
Okay, and you'll never be allowed to forget it, given that you married into Cork.
No, she's from Waterford, but we met in UCC.
Just a very important clarification. You mentioned in the speech you just gave that many people still consider 66 South Mall to be AIB's spiritual home. Mm. I mean, there is a great link between Cork and AIB through the various iterations that became the bank that's the country's biggest today.
Yeah, so the largest single bank within Allied Irish Banks, because that's what AIB means, is the Munster and Leinster Bank, which of course was headquartered on 66 South Mall for so many years, and it was only in the late 1960s that the bank's headquarters was established in Dublin. So we have a very, very long and proud heritage here. If you look at the role we play in terms of the banking life of the city and county, I don't think there's any other place in Ireland where our presence is stronger or more widespread than it is here in Cork. We've got 33 branches right the way across the city and county, and that's a huge number in the context of a nationwide footprint of about 205 branches.
One of the comments you made this morning that resonated with me was your comment that we are either at or past the peak of the Irish economic cycle. So soon after the last one, that might fill people with a little bit of fear. I mean, do you genuinely believe right now is at the top?
Well, it's more a global economic cycle rather than an Irish economic cycle. And in fact, this has been an extraordinarily long cycle. You know, there's nigh on 7, 8, 9 years now of very, very strong economic expansion globally. But all the indicators are suggesting that this is getting a bit tired. It's getting quite old, and you're looking at interest rate expectations falling. You're looking at leading indicators of manufacturing activity, in particular, right the way around the world, falling. And to some extent, that's driven by trade tensions because of the US and China and the US and the European Union. But there's also, I think, a little bit of concern that this is a cycle which is coming to an end. And I think if we're not at the top, we're very close to it, and we may well be beyond it. But we're not going to see anything like the sort of damage done to the economy that was done the last time round. We don't have anything like the sort of imbalances in the economy that we had the last time round. I suspect we'll have a more moderate clip, but that will be driven by what's happening in the outside world, not least Brexit.
You also referenced the amount of non-performing loans that you had. You had 31 billion, which is an eye-watering amount at the worst peak of the crisis. 31 billion, that's down to 4.7 billion, which is still very high by European standards. Could Brexit start pushing that in the wrong direction despite everything that you've done?
Well, in a hard Brexit situation, you would expect that your credit losses will go up rather than down. That number may well move in the wrong direction, but we're determined to continue to make progress on it, because we have to. We've got to get our balance sheet into the strongest possible position, because it's only when we're in a position of strength that we can support our customers to the maximum extent.
You talked about talking to your customers. How ready are they to engage with the bank? Because the bank became the enemy for many during the downtime. That people didn't necessarily trust the bank to be acting in their best interests. We know that a lot of that non-performing loan book, within that there were those who probably could pay and just decided not to. I know that old chestnut is still floating around. But when you look at it now, how is the relationship between AIB customers and the bank post-crash?
It's 10 years post the crisis. There's no doubt about it that the crisis continues to cast a long shadow. There's obviously an acute awareness both within the bank and within the country that the bank required the support of the Irish taxpayer to the tune of 20.8 billion to make sure that it can continue to operate at the trough of the global financial crisis. The scale of the damage inflicted was so significant that it is an inevitability that it takes time for relationships to be fully repaired, or at least reputation to be fully repaired. Now, we've got very strong relationships with our customers. I meet an awful lot of them. I spend a huge amount of time out in the network meeting people and meeting customers, meeting staff. And I think that the relationships we have are good and are strengthening. Because you know there is a symbiotic relationship between the bank and its customers. Strong customers makes for a strong bank, and we can't have strong customers without a strong bank. So it works both ways.
But arguably, you're not there yet. The bank, not just yours, but all of them, PTSB, Bank of Ireland, yourselves, Ulster, all seen more as causing the crash rather than being part of the solution. And in terms of that mindset, is that ever going to fully recover?
I think it's going to take a lot of time. We have called out three particular areas that we want to work on to help that process, to help in the rehabilitation of our reputation. We want to have an ever more open and transparent culture. We want to have ever clearer lines of accountability. And we want to make an ever-increasing a contribution to the sustainability of the communities that we live and work in. But it is going to take time. The crisis was of such a severe nature that it will take time and hard work, but that hard work is now underway.
You mentioned the billions that the taxpayer had to pour into your bank alone to steady the ship. Could that happen again?
I'm determined that it will never happen again. I'm determined that the liquidity position of the bank, the capital position of the bank, and its overall balance sheet is so, so strong that this will never arise. And of course, we've had regulatory change, we've had structural change in terms of having a holdco and an operating company now. But the best guard against that ever happening again is that we make decisions that are appropriate, long-termist, sustainable, and profitable. And that is where our focus is. We have a very well-capitalized bank now, and I am determined to ensure that remains the case, regardless of the state of the economy that we're dealing with.
Do you foresee a time in the not-so-distant future where it will be fully in private ownership again?
That's a decision for the Minister for Finance. My job and the job of all my colleagues in AIB Group is to ensure the bank is in the best shape to be brought to market if and when the Minister so decides.
So there would be no reason why it couldn't be if the Minister decided?
It's a matter for the government. I'm very much focused on running the bank, running it to the best of my ability, keeping it focused on its customers, keeping it in a strong position. That's a decision for the Minister.
Colin, one of the things that constantly comes up when we look back was the amount of money the people in jobs got paid. Your salary is constantly under scrutiny, yep, as all the others are. You took the job. You probably, in a different era, would have gotten more money for it. Do you see the rationale for people keeping scrutiny on the CEO's salary as a benchmark as to how well the bank should be doing?
Oh, absolutely. Of course I do. And by any measure, I'm well paid. My concern about the restrictions that are in place is a far, far broader concern. My concern about the restrictions relates more to our inability to pay variable pay to staff members, and we are competing for the same in the same pool for the same pool of talent with companies, international companies that aren't restrained to the same way that we are. But certainly, you know, I can understand why, very much understand why the restrictions were introduced. I very much understand the focus that is on them. I have to concede that my primary area of concern in this area is how it impacts on my ability to retain staff, typically staff in their late 20s and early 30s, because of the effective ban on variable pay.
Okay, so in other words, it is more, it's as much of an issue further down the chain than it is at the top.
I believe it probably is. From a competitiveness viewpoint, from the point of view of being able to recruit and retain talent, I think it probably is a more pressing issue down the chain. Certainly, I took the job in the full knowledge of what the deal was, this has been the greatest privilege of my professional life and the highest office to which I aspire to have this job, and I took it with my eyes wide open.
You mentioned sustainability as well earlier on. The green economy is something that we are told is the future, between maybe car loans for electric cars to financing wind farms or financing new solar projects that might be out there. It would be great in theory if a bank such as yours, the biggest in the country, got behind such projects. But you are open to the accusation that this is greenwashing. You're merely playing lip service to this and it's not something you're taking seriously. How seriously are you taking this?
Well, I rejoined the bank in August of 2016. And the first time I brought a strategic initiative to board was 3 years ago, actually. And the very first strategic initiative I brought, looking for support of our board, was to establish a specialist centre to deal with climate action, to deal with green lending. And that was in 2016, practically within 3 short months of me rejoining the bank. It's an area of acute concern for me. It's been an area of concern for the bank for a long time. We're about to publish our third sustainability report. It is something that we've been working on internally for many years in terms of reducing our carbon footprint. And I can completely understand that some companies might fall victim to accusations of greenwashing, but this is something that has been at the very top of our agenda for a very considerable period of time.
Put a number out then. What do you envisage giving out in terms of loans to this type of venture in the future?
Well, we have a 5 billion fund which we've allocated, 1 billion a year for the next 5 years. I personally believe that is probably going to be comfortably exceeded. But we're putting out a de minimis target now that we'll hit 1 billion of green lending every single year. And we'll do it in ways, like, I suppose when people think about green lending, they think about energy and they think about electricity generation. But there's a number of important features or aspects to the green agenda. One, absolutely, having renewable energy, wind, solar, biomass, anaerobic digestion. There's also transport, trying to encourage the shift towards more energy-efficient transportation. And one of the big wins, though, and something that doesn't get too much attention, is housing. And in particular, the retrofitting of housing, so as to reduce the energy consumption of households the length and breadth of the country. There's a huge saving in terms of money, there's a huge saving in terms of energy, and we want to have a range of products that will support such a welcome development.
On housing, do you feel that the central bank's restrictions are having too much of an effect now and are chilling the market still? The idea that well-paid couples can't get a mortgage because they cannot get the deposit together. Is it time to revisit those?
I can completely understand why the central bank introduced the macroprudential rules. They were introduced for very, very good reasons, which was that given the scale of the imbalance between demand and supply in the housing market, like even after 5 or 6 years of recovery, we'll still produce about 22,000 units this year, whereas the demand for homes is of the order of about 35,000 homes every single year. So there's still a big imbalance there. And given the scale of that imbalance, without us having these sort of macroprudential rules, there was a very severe risk we would have had runaway house price inflation. And we know that is damaging in the long term. this country knows better than many, many countries the damage that can be inflicted by runaway house price inflation. So they were introduced for the right reasons, and they've been extraordinarily effective. And we've seen an ongoing moderation of the pace of house price inflation to the point now where it's probably at zero. So I suppose the point that I've been making is these are rules that are not set in stone. They should be open to review. They are open to review, and as I understand it, there's a review currently underway. And I think that it's important that in reviewing the rules, the central bank needs to be cognizant of the prevailing economic and market conditions.
In other words, they should loosen them in such a way that we have more housing stock.
They should certainly review them in a way which takes account of the fact that the dangers of runaway house price inflation are lower now than they were somewhat earlier.
You mentioned the bank needing to be rehabilitated in the eyes of the public. One of the biggest damage-causing episodes was the Tracker mortgage scandal, which you've said sorry for, and all the other banks have said sorry for. Is that firmly over at this point?
Well, the examination phase, which was conducted by the central bank, is now complete, and we have made over 99% of the restitutions that were required as a result of that examination. So the examination phase is now over.
You weren't there. You joined the bank again in 2016. But as CEO now, looking back on it, did AIB handle that, and all the banks handle that, appallingly badly?
I think there was a series of errors. I think that there was process failures that were endemic right the way across the industry. And I think it was a reflection of the very, very difficult time that the country faced that these decisions were made. The organization has worked quickly and efficiently, I think, to address these issues, to do it comprehensively, and to make repayments to the affected customers as quickly as possible. My determination is to ensure this never happens again. I'm very conscious of the fact that even 10 years post-crisis, I still have in and around 20% of our headcount dealing with what I describe as legacy issues, so trackers and non-performing exposures. And I want to ensure that we move the bank onto a front foot and that we look forward, because that's the best way we can support the economy and support all our customers. But certainly, I want to draw a line under the tracker issue, and I believe that we are very, very close to that now.
Cork is in a good place, as you would have seen driving in. Mm-hmm. The quays have huge construction mm-hmm. going on. The economy is quite buoyant, and there is still an optimism out there. That's fed by the likes of the Ludgate mm-hmm. Centre, which you would have visited in Skibbereen mm-hmm. yesterday, that AIB is sponsor on. There is an appetite out there that Ireland can do more, that Ireland will do more.
Mm. Well, I'm hugely optimistic about the future of the country. I look at our entrepreneurialism, I look at our confidence, I look at the fact that we are genuinely externally oriented. We look to the world for our living. And then I look at the fundamentals, which are, it all boils down to the quality of your people and your demographics. And our demographics are amongst the very best in Europe. So we have all the necessary ingredients for a prolonged period of societal and economic advance. And I'm really, really positive about the future potential of this country. We're always going to have to deal with the vagaries of the cycle. We're going to always have to deal with bumpier periods and then more pleasant periods. But I think that the long-term trend is very firmly upward in this country. And I am very, very positive about the prospects, not only for ourselves, but for our children and our grandchildren.
you are one of the lead sponsors in Cork 300 as well, this big celebration of yachting, for the want of a better expression, and wider maritime life here in Cork. Cork Chambers 200 this year. There's an awful lot of celebrations that AIB have to be part of this year.
Well, of course, Cork's kicked off all these celebrations back in 1985 with Cork 800. You were the first ones to come to come to the realisation that having a big party had a powerful resonance on a city's vibrancy. Of course, followed by Dublin 3 years later, but who'd had to go to
a poor imitation.
Who had to go 200 more than you with 1,000, but Cork was first out of the blocks, and we're thrilled to be associated with the Cork 300 celebrations next year. It's an extraordinary achievement. The RCYC holds a very, very special place in the global maritime community. And Cork is very much a city in touch with its maritime history and its maritime present. And I think it's wonderful that one of the biggest events of this nature globally will be held here. So it's wonderful and very fitting that that event will be held here next year, and we're thrilled to be associated with it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be fabulous. I've spoken to the team about the plans they have. You won't be able to move in Cork without realising it's a full week-long festival, and everybody, even if they're not into the life at sea, will get something out of it. Colin, we wish you and the 800 people working with you in Cork across those 33 branches the very best of luck. Thank you so much for giving us your time here today. And here's hoping if Cork are playing Waterford in here, it'll be better for the home side next time out. Colin Hunt, CEO of AIB, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan.
My thanks to Colin Hunt for joining us on Red Business. Don't forget, you can download every episode of the podcast from redextra.ie. Niamh Hennessy produced, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Red Business. All that's best about business in Cork.